the side of the foremost platform to wave at them, Vaynin recognizing Bren Antesh's silhouette. He sensed a certain impatience in the archer's movements. "I think your Lord of Archers is keen for you to join him aloft," he advised. "In which case he'll be disappointed," she replied with a level gaze. He let the matter drop. Cautioning her seemed irrelevant given their mission. A wasteful gamble, Count Marvin had called it, not without justification. Vaynin looked at the two ships following in their wake, the only Valerian vessels captured by the Meldinians during their brief campaign, each crammed with more Seorda. Beyond the horizon waited all the ships they could commandeer on short notice, 30 vessels laden with more forest folk and 3 regiments of Realm Guard, including the Wolf Runners. The cream of this new army gambled on an expectation of Valerian arrogance. The Shield had sailed into Warnsclave a day after Belarath's arrival, his great flagship laden with stolen supplies, relating his dismay at failing to seize a ship of equal size and design to his own newly acquired monster. "It was like fighting a mirror image," he told Lerna, his usual ebullience muted somewhat, and unlike most, less inclined to stare at her face. "Except one captain via fool," he went on. "Sadly, the fires we birthed in her were too great, and she went down, along with a few 100 free swords, judging by the screams." The idea had been birthed then, triggering instincts Vaylin had thought lost with his song. "They expect the Stormspite's twin at Varenthold." He had pondered it for a day and a night before seeking the Queen's approval. "We don't have ships enough for the whole army," she reminded him. "But enough to seize the docks, and Varenthold will stand or fall on who holds them. Plus, Brother Canis will relate the need to attack on Winterfall Eve to the Renfalen host via Brother Lernil." "The odds," she shook her head. "Even if these Renfalens, whoever they are, do ride to our aid, the odds still do not favor us. Marvin is right. The risk is too great." "Not for the Seorda," he said. "Not if they make the first attack, aided by Lady Reva's archers. The docks will be taken within an hour." "Their prowess impresses you that much?" He recalled the Curatai that day as the rain beat down, swift and deadly but seeming like slow children as the forest folk broke their line. "You didn't see them at Altor, Highness." He straightened, addressing her formally. "My queen, as battle lord, I tell you, this is the only way Varenthold will be in our hands before the year's end." "By the Father." Reva's whisper brought him back to the present. She stood at the rail as they rounded the southern headland, and Varenthold came into view. For a moment, Vaylin felt certain they had sailed to liberate nothing more than a ruin, the entire southern quarter seemingly just a mass of piled brick and blackened wood. As they drew closer, however, he began to pick out familiar buildings still standing amidst the rubble. The merchants' houses overlooking the harbour, the northern wing of the palace just visible through the fading morning mist. And in the centre, the dark stump of the Blackhold, where he hoped the aspect still drew breath. Reva turned back from the view, her face grim, waving at the archers above, who promptly crouched, disappearing from view. The Shield donned a shirt of broad-ringed mail and buckled on his sabre. "Best if you stay by me, my lady," he told Reva with a wink. "I'll protect you." This time she failed to laugh, the sight of the city seemingly robbing her of humour. "It's they who need protection," she muttered, jerking her head at the Valerians now visible on the quay. Her face had taken on a tense aspect, her brow furrowed and gaze focused. On any other woman her age, it might be taken for sullenness. But Vaylin knew it was the face she wore throughout the siege, the face so many Valerians had seen in their final seconds of life. He reached out to place a hand on her shoulder, and she clasped it before he moved away, going to the prow. Norta's chosen men were coming up on deck, dressed in their Valerian gear, his brother making a convincing freesword battalion commander as he arrayed them in good order. He would be first down the gangplank to exchange salutes with whatever senior Valerian came to greet their arrival, before striking them dead and leading the charge against their escort, the Cumbrainian archers raining death on all others. The sails were trimmed as they approached the harbour mouth, all in silence, to prevent those ashore wondering why Meldinian voices could be heard on a Valerian ship. Vaylin could see their reception more clearly now. neatly arrayed rows of free swords standing to the rear of a single officer, hopefully the senior Valerian commander in the city. A cheering sight, since the man would probably be the one to greet Norta, or if not, would be almost certain to die in the arrow storm. Off to the left stood a tall figure on a warhorse, long dark hair tied back from his handsome face. Lerna had given orders for Darnell to be taken alive if possible, keen to extract whatever intelligence he held regarding Valerian plans. But Valen gave little for the man's chances once the realm guard came ashore. He would have to get the shield to spirit him away. He straightened as Darnell's horse abruptly began to rear, tipping its master from the saddle and lashing about with its hooves. For a second, all was confusion as the horse went wild, trampling men and charging away. Then he saw a slender young man rushing towards Darnell, a faint gleam of steel in his hand. A Lucius! He saw it all, standing helpless as the ship inched closer to the shore, saw Darnell's sword cut through Lucius's chest, saw a tall, familiar figure impale Darnell with the spike he wore in place of a hand, saw the Valerian commander marshal his men in response.
Antesh!
Valen called, cupping his hands and casting his voice at the platforms. The Lord Archer's head appeared above the platform edge, and Valen pointed to the wharf.
Kill them all!
Reva appeared at his side. What is it?
Forget the plan, he told her, reaching over his shoulder to draw his sword, the key no more than 10 feet away now. Tell Norta to get his people ashore and start killing.
He hoisted himself onto the rail, watching the arrows streak down from above, Valerians falling by the dozen. Alhestian visible through the milling confusion, crouched protectively over his son's body. Valen took a final judging glance at the key and leapt from the rail, landing hard and rolling to absorb the shock. He sprinted towards Alhestian, finding his way blocked by a knot of free swords, using their comrades' bodies as shields as they backed away under the orders of a veteran sergeant. Valen hacked his way into their midst, laying about with his sword in a two-handed grip, two falling in quick succession, the veteran sergeant skewered through chest and neck by multiple arrows, the others attempting to flee, but soon tumbling to the stones under the deadly rain. Valen ran on, cutting down any Valerian who contrived to block his path. The sword flashed with all the effortless, terrible grace he had thought lost, parrying and killing as he moved without conscious decision. Perhaps it was never the song, he thought grimly, sidestepping a thrust from a free sword and moving behind him to lay open the back of his neck. You don't need a song to be a killer. He saw Alhestian ahead, still crouched over Lucius, a group of Valerians rushing towards him. Something thrummed past Valen's ear, and the lead Valerian fell dead with an arrow protruding from his breastplate. Valen glanced behind to see Reva notching and loosing arrows from her finely carved bow with a speed and precision he knew he would never match. He sped on towards Alhestian, seeing two more free swords fall to Reva's arrows. Another came close enough to hack down at the former battle lord. Valen leapt, extending his blade to block the blow, hammering a fist into the man's face. The man staggered, drawing his short sword back for a riposte, then snapped his head back and collapsed as one of Reva's arrows found his eye.
Alusius!
Valen shoved Alhestian aside and crouched next to the poet, his eyes tracking over the terrible wound in his chest to his face. The features bleached white, eyes half closed. Reva crouched at his side, touching a hand to Alusius's face, sighing in sorrow.
Drunken sot, she muttered.
Weaver, Valen said, standing to cast his gaze out to sea. He's on the third ship with the other gifted.
Valen, she said, reaching out to grasp his arm. He's gone. He stood, dragging his gaze from Alusius's body as the Siorda swept past them on either side, tearing through the hastily assembled ranks of free swords, cutting their line apart. Some fought, hacking and stabbing with their short swords at the two swift, silent phantoms that assailed them, their blades finding only air as they fell by the dozen. Others fled, sprinting away through the ruins or throwing themselves into the harbour, willing to risk drowning rather than face such an onslaught. Here and there, Curatai could be seen, managing to strike a blow or two before they were clubbed down. Beyond the slaughter, Valen could see a dense formation of Valerians building in the more open ground near the warehouse district, neat ranks of Varitai falling into place with their uncanny precision.
"They'll fall back to the palace."
Velen turned to find Lacryl Alhestian regarding him with a vacant frown, his voice dull, listless.
"There are fire traps surrounding it. They could hold out for days."
He looked down at Eleusis once more, bent to retrieve the dagger still clutched in the poet's hand, and raised it towards his own throat.
Velen's punch jabbed into the nerve cluster below Alhestian's nose, leaving him unconscious on the stones.
"Muster your archers on the quay," he told Reva, nodding towards the dense ranks of Varitai, now attempting a fighting withdrawal into the city, the Siorda continually harrying them with volleys of arrows from their flat bows.
Despite their retreat, he knew this was far from over. He could see more Valerian formations moving through the ruins, battalions forming in the northern quarter with more to the west. He saw Norta a short distance away, mustering his fighters amidst the remnants of a free sword company, sword bloody from end to end.
"Move towards the north gate," he called to him. "Stop them joining up. I'll send the realm guard to join you when they dock."
Norta nodded, then drew up short at the sight of something towards the east, laughing and pointing his reddened blade.
"Perhaps that won't be necessary, brother."
Velen heard him before they came into view, a great cacophonous clatter of steel on stone. Clearly the Valerian commander heard it too, as he attempted to switch companies to his left flank, all too late. The knights tore into the Valerian ranks, long swords and maces rising and falling as they hacked their way through the Varitai, cutting the formation in two. The Siorda charged in to complete the destruction. A fine red mist of mingled blood, breath, and steaming horse sweat rising to cover the raging carnage. The Varitai, unlike the free swords, didn't know how to flee and fought to the last. Velen ordered Norta to join up with Reva's archers and sweep towards the palace.
"There's still half a division to kill," he told them. "Take no chances. Keep them divided and let the archers do their work."
He waited for the realm guard to come ashore, the wolf runners the first regiment to arrive, now commanded by a former corporal Velen vaguely remembered from the Alpiran War.
"Set guards on this man,"
Velen ordered, pointing to Alhestian's unconscious form. He took a final glance at Eleusis, knowing he would have to be the one to tell Alornis, and feeling like a coward for hating the duty.
"And secure this man's body," he said. "The queen will wish to say words when we give him to the fire."
He walked through the scene of the Varitai's defeat, a dense carpet of bodies breasting the wharf from end to end. A broad-chested knight on a tall charger trotted up to him, trampling bodies and breaking bones under hoof. He pushed back the red-painted visor covering his face, greeting Velen with a forced laugh.
"Quite the spectacle, eh, my lord?"
"Baron," Velen bowed, "I had hoped it would be you."
A young, bare-headed knight guided his horse to Banda's side, his bright gaze alighting on Velen for a moment before scanning the quayside with intense scrutiny.
"Where is he?" he demanded, hefting a gore-covered longsword.
"Arundel, my grandson," Banders explained to Velen. "He's keen to meet Lord Darnell."
"Back there, young sir," Velen pointed over his shoulder. "Quite dead, I'm afraid."
The young knight slumped in his saddle, sword arm sagging. His face betrayed as much relief as disappointment.
"Well, at least it's over."
He brightened at the sight of a group of people approaching along Gate Lane, at the run, raising his hand in a welcoming wave. Velen initially took them for some of Norta's fighters, but soon realized they were an even more unusual mix, varying greatly in age and garb, including a girl of no more than 16, a Lonak woman of impressive stature, and a muscular young man with an order blade. Francis stared at him as he approached, a faint smile on his lips. Velen halted a few feet away, taking in the sight of a man who was both brother and stranger. His frame was even more impressive now, powerful and, Velen noted, free of scars, judging by the skin visible through his torn shirt. His face also had lost the youthful smoothness he remembered, hard lines forming around the mouth and eyes. For once, Velen was grateful for the song's absence, as he found himself uncertain he wanted to know what those eyes had seen.
"I heard you died," he said.
Frentice's smile widened. "Whilst I knew you couldn't have." Seeing his evident and genuine warmth, Velen felt his sorrow deepen yet further. "I require your sword, brother," he said, holding out his hand. Francis's smile slowly faded, and he glanced at the people flanking him before nodding, coming forward to proffer his blade, hilt first. Velen took it and beckoned the Wolfrunner's new commander forward. "This man," he said, "is bound by the Queen's word to answer for the murder of King Malthus. He is to be shackled and confined pending her judgment." Part 2. It is a singular mistake to think of the slave as fully human. Freedom is a privilege afforded by the excellence of our lineage as true Valerian citizens. By contrast, the slave station, earned through birth to enslaved parents, just defeat in war, or a demonstrated lack of industry and intelligence, is not merely the artificial construct of society. It is the accurate reflection of a natural order. It therefore follows that attempts to upset this order, through misguided policy or even outright rebellion, are always doomed to failure. Councilman Lorvec Irlaf, Valeria, the apex of civilization, Great Library of the Unified Realm. Librarian's note, text incomplete due to partial burning. Vernier's account. In contrast to my first voyage aboard this ship, I found myself provided with a cabin, once occupied by the first mate, who had perished at the Battle of the Teeth. Our captain stated loudly to his threadbare crew that he had yet to find a worthy replacement, and I might as well have it, since none of these dogs deserved the honour. The welcoming prospect of shipborne comfort, however, was diminished by his insistence that I share the space with my former owner. "She's your prisoner, scribe," he stated. "You guard her." "To what end?" I inquired, gesturing at the surrounding ocean. "To where is she likely to escape, pray tell?" "Might damage the ship," he replied with a shrug. "Might throw herself to a passing shark. Either way, she's your responsibility, and I've no hands spare to watch her." "It's a small bed," she observed as the cabin door slammed shut behind us. "Still, I don't mind sharing." I pointed to a corner of the cabin. "Your place is there, mistress. If you're quiet, I might spare you a blanket." "Or what?" she asked, pointedly sitting on the narrow bunk. "Will you flog me? Bend me to your will with cruel torment?" She smiled and I turned away, going to a small map table set into the woodwork below the portal. "There are a dozen men on this ship who will happily mete out all the correction you require," I said, reaching into my bag and extracting the first scroll to hand. "I have no doubt," she agreed. "Will you watch?" My dear husband liked to watch when the slave girls were whipped. He'd often pleasure himself at the sight. "Will you do the same, my lord?" I sighed, biting down a response and unfurling the scroll. An illustrated catalogue of Valerian ceramics. Brother Harlech's precise but overly florid letters provoking me to an amused grunt. Even the man's script is pompous. Although I couldn't pretend any liking for the brother, I had to concede Harlech's draftsmanship was excellent. The illustrations possessed of a flawless exactitude, the first depicting a hunting scene from a vase dating back some 1500 years, naked spearmen pursuing a stag through pine forest. "Ceramics," Fornella said, peering over my shoulder. "You think the Allies' origins lurk in pots, my lord?" I didn't look up from the scroll. When studying an age often bereft of writing, decorative illustration can be highly informative. If you can enlighten me as to another course, I would be grateful. "How grateful?" she asked, leaning close, breath soft on my ear. I merely shook my head and returned to the scroll as she laughed and moved away. "You really have no interest in women at all, do you?" "My interest in women varies according to the woman in question." I unfurled the scroll further, finding more hunting scenes, some images of ritual worship, various gods and creatures of bizarre design. "I can help," she said. "I would like to." I turned, finding her expression cautious but earnest. "Why?" "We have a long voyage ahead. And whatever you may suspect of my motives, I am keen to see this mission succeed." I looked again at the image on the scroll, naked revelers frolicking before a great ape-like creature, mouth agape and vomiting fire. "Kethian jug fragment," read the inscription below the image. "Pre-imperial." "When, exactly," I asked her, "did the Volarians give up their gods?" "It was all long before my birth," she said. "Long before my mother's birth, in fact. But she was ever a studious woman, and keen for me to learn the history of our most glorious empire. We had repaired to the deck, sitting near the prow as she spoke, and I scribbled my notes. The captain had growled something at our appearance, but made no protest, and the crew seemed happy to ignore us, bar a few hostile glances at Fornella. "The Empire may speak with one tongue now," she went on, "and follow the Council's edicts, be they denizens of the greatest city or the foulest swamp. But it was not always so." "I know your empire was forged in war," I said. "Many wars, in fact, lasting some 3 centuries. "Quite so. But whilst the forging age left us with an empire, true unity eluded us for centuries to come. There were too many different coins with too many different values, too many languages spoken by too many tongues, and far too many gods. My mother used to say that men would fight and kill for money, but they would only die for their gods. For the empire to endure, we required that kind of loyalty, untainted by any divine distraction. And so there were more wars, called the Wars of Persecution by some, but imperial historians refer to the entire period as the Great Cleansing, a 60-year trial of blood and torture. Whole provinces were laid waste, and entire peoples took flight, some to the northern hills, others across the sea, to found new nations free of Valerian persecution. But for all we lost, it was this that truly birthed the empire, for this is when we became a nation of slavers. There had always been slaves, of course, mostly in the Valerian heartland. But now there were more, conquered for refusing to give up their gods, beaten, cowed, and bred so successive generations forgot them altogether. To marshal such a resource requires 2 things, great organization and vast cruelty. I often think it was these particular traits the ally found so alluring. After all, we must have been chosen for a reason. Do you know when he made himself known? I know not whether the ally is male or even truly human. My mother told of a time, near 4 centuries ago, when the empire was strong in its unity. War with the Alperians was nothing new, but it took on a new intensity. The battles grew in size, the campaigns lasted years instead of months, though victory still eluded us. Eventually the Alperians became tired of our endless attacks, and launched one of their own, overrunning the southern provinces in a matter of months. Crisis has a tendency to reveal noteworthy talent, and thus it was that a young general from the southern city of Myrtesk rose to prominence, a general with a revolutionary notion, and the means to make it happen. If our slaves could build our cities and work our fields, why not also fight our wars? And so via this newfound knowledge, we created the Varitae and Curitae. Through tactical genius and prodigious use of his slave soldiers, our new general won eternal fame by driving the Alperians back. He was lauded the length and breadth of the empire. Statues were raised in his honour, epics composed by our finest scholars to document his wondrous life. Fornella paused, her lips forming a wry smile, though her eyes betrayed a sadness I hadn't seen before. But it was not a normal life. For our young general stayed young. Whilst his fellow officers grew old and withered around him, he stayed young. He was the first, I said. Indeed, the first Valerian blessed by the ally's voice, or, I assume, the first he sent one of his creatures to seduce. But his gifts didn't end with the secret of binding slaves so completely they would fight and die at their master's command. No, he had more to offer. The greatest gift of all. It was from him the Council learned the secret of endless life, at the Allies' behest, of course. And over time, they all made themselves its creatures. The General became the Allies' voice on the Council, speaking softly at first, guiding rather than commanding, hinting at the great task it had chosen for the Empire. Although, as the years passed, the General's behaviour became ever more erratic. My mother said she met him once, at a feast held in his honour. My family is, as you may understand, vastly wealthy, and has held a council seat since the Empire's earliest days. I asked my mother what he was like, and she laughed. "Quite dreadfully mad," she said, "though I hear his daughter is worse."
"His daughter?" I asked.
Fenella pulled her woolen shawl tighter about her shoulders, the sadness fading into fearful remembrance. "Yes, a daughter. I met her, too, once. One meeting was more than sufficient."
"Are they like you, the general and his daughter? Do they still live?"
"The general's madness grew with the centuries, his hunger for victory over the Alpirans becoming a madman's obsession, birthing a calamitous defeat. The council, by now all recipients of the blessing, and advised by the Allies' other lieutenants that the general's glorious career should reach a conclusion, employed their chief assassin to provide one. If what the Queen says is true, however, she may well have met her end alongside King Malsyas."
"The general's daughter? She killed her own father?"
"She's taken countless lives the breadth of this world, my lord. If we're fortunate, she'll plague us no more. But I increasingly find fortune to be a rare commodity."
"Does your mother still live? Did she also take the Allies' blessing?"
She shook her head, raising her gaze to meet mine, smiling fondly. "No. She grew old and she died, though I begged her to join me in this new age of limitless life. She alone knew the true nature of the bargain we had struck, though none would listen to her. She knew what drew the ally, if not what had birthed it."
"And what is it? What draws it?"
"Power. That's how the first were chosen. Not those with the greatest wealth, but those with the most influence, the greatest sway in council. Because it happened over decades rather than years, only one being chosen to receive his bounteous gift in every dozen years. It seemed the choosing was random, the whim of a being as close to a god as any could be. But my mother lived long enough to see the pattern. Every bargain struck increased its hold on us. Every gift bestowed made us more its servants. She said just one word the last time I was permitted near her, before she ordered me barred from her house. She was nearly 90 years in age, just a tiny collection of bone and skin in a very large bed. But her mind had never faded, and her eyes were so very bright, and though she could only speak in whispers, I heard it, clear and true, though at the time I thought it just the final croak of a bitter old woman. She fell silent, gazing off towards the southern horizon, where a heavy cloud bank could be seen, signalling an uncomfortable night. Not that I expected to sleep much lying by her side. There was more grey in her hair now, I saw, watching it swirl in the wind. "Just one word," she said in a faint voice. "Slave." As I had predicted, sleep proved elusive. The sea grew turbulent come nightfall, the wind rising to lash the clouded glass of the porthole with rain and howl through the myriad channels in the fabric of this ship. Fenella lay on her back, breathing slow and regular. I lay on my side, turned towards the hull. I had removed my shoes, but was otherwise fully clad whilst she was naked, sloughing off her clothes without the slightest flicker of embarrassment, slipping into the bed beside me as I turned my back. We lay in silence for the better part of an hour, robbed of rest by the wind and the sheer oddness of our circumstance. Finally she said, "Do you hate me, my lord?" "Hatred requires passion," I replied. "Ah, the Cantos of Golden Dust, verse 20. Don't you think it a trifle conceited to constantly quote your own work?" The verse was drawn from an ancient ode sung by the tribes of the Western Mountains, as noted in my introduction. She gave a soft laugh. "So I do not stir your passion?" "Hardly surprising, given your preferences. Still, a woman accustomed to male admiration can't help but feel somewhat slighted." I felt her shift behind me, moving to lie on her side. "Who was he, the man you said you loved?" "I will not discuss that with you." Something in my tone must have held sufficient warning, because she gave a sigh of amused frustration before persisting. "I may have something to stir your passion, at least as far as it relates to your lust for knowledge. A small nugget of information concerning the ally.
I gritted my teeth hard, wondering if I didn't in fact hate her after all. I sat up, turning to find her regarding me with head tilted on her pillow, the gloom sufficient to hide all but the gleam of her eyes. "Then tell me," I said. "The name," she insisted. I rose, turning my back to swing my legs off the bed. "Selisen Maxtor Aluran," I said. I had expected laughter, cruel and mocking, but instead her tone was calmly reflective. "The hope of the Alperian Empire, slain by the very man who destroyed my darling husband's army. My people do not hold to notions of fate. The concept of invisible forces moving to shape our destiny is anathema to a people cleansed of superstition. But there are times when I wonder." I felt her shift again, her warm nakedness pressing against my back, resting her head against my shoulder. There was no desire in the way she held to me, at least none I could sense, just a need for closeness. "My sorrow for your loss, honored sir," she said in formal Alperin. "My brother is the longest-serving member of the Valerian High Council, so he knows the Allies' schemes better than most, and even he is blind to their true nature, their ultimate purpose. However, its servants have often spoken of a man, endless in years like us, but not enthralled to the blood of the gifted. A man who has lived many lifetimes, and walked around the world more than once. The ally is drawn to power, as I said, and what greater power is there than the defeat of death itself? It seeks him? Indeed, but never has it found him. And he has a name, this endless man? 1,000, changed with every lifetime as he passes from nation to nation. One of the Allies' creatures, the one they call the Messenger, caught his scent some 15 years ago in the Unified Realm. He was calling himself Erlin." Chapter 1. Lerna. It took some time to find her garden, the ruins having been cleared by Darnell's slaves to make way for his architectural ambitions, leaving only an outline of stunted brick and bare earth where flowers had once grown. Strangely, her bench was still intact, if somewhat blackened. She sat, surveying the wasted remnants of the vanished refuge she had cherished. It was here she had led Valin that night, winning his enmity with her clumsy intrigues, but learning a lesson in the process. Some eyes will always see through a mask. Here also she had spent those delightful hours with Sister Sherin, after securing her release from the Blackhold, the healer's innate kindness and sparkling intellect dispelling jealousy for the most part. Lerna remembered finding friendship an enjoyable if brief novelty, and when Sherin sailed away to Linesh, she had stopped coming here. The secluded courtyard no longer felt like a welcoming haven, just an empty corner of a palace where a lonely woman nursed flowers and schemes whilst she waited for her father to die. "Lerna!" She raised her gaze in time to catch a glimpse of a tall figure striding towards her, before Devoka's embrace forced the air from her lungs and pulled her from the bench, her feet coming free of the ground as she was crushed into the Lonak woman's chest. Lerna heard the pounding of boots, accompanied by a sword scraping free of scabbards. "Unhand our queen, savage!" Iltis snarled. Devoka ignored him, releasing Lerna after a final crushing squeeze, clasping her head in both hands. She was smiling, something Lerna found she couldn't remember her doing before. "I thought I'd lost you, sister," she said in Lonak, fingers tracing over her face, from her brow to the rapidly growing red-gold locks beyond. "He said you burned." "I did." Lerna clasped her hands and kissed them, nodding reassurance at Iltis and Benton, who sheathed their swords, retreating with bows and bemused expressions. "I still do, sister." Devoka stepped back, a certain tense reluctance showing in her gaze before she spoke again, slipping into realm tongue with practiced ease. "Brother Frentis." Lerna turned away from her, Devoka falling silent at the sudden sharpness in her expression. Mention of the famed Red Brother had been frequent since her arrival the previous evening, amongst the first words spoken by her battle lord on disembarking at the docks, as well as a heartfelt entreaty from Aspect Alera, and a clipped request for mercy from Brother Solis. She had given the same answer to each of them,
the same answer she gave Devoka now. "Judgment will be rendered in due course." "We fought together in the forest before it burned," Devoka went on. "We are Gorin. He is my brother, as you are my sister." The Valerian woman's red tears, the searing pain as her hair caught alight. Lerna closed her eyes against the memories, feeling the breeze on her skin, her healed, unmarred skin. "Healed?" she asked herself. "Is that what I am?" The night before, she had watched the Lucius on the fire. She had spoken briefly beforehand, formally naming him Sword of the Realm, his sigil to be a pen and a wine cup, for she knew it would have made him laugh. Lady Alornis stepped forward to add her voice, face pale and expressionless, but with tears streaming from her eyes as her brother laid comforting hands on her shoulders. "Alucius Alhestian," she began, faltered, then continued in a broken voice, "will be called a hero by many, a poet by others, and—" She paused to form a faint smile. "Overfond of wine by some. I will always call him, simply, my friend." Lacryl Alhestian had been permitted to attend, standing by, hollow-eyed and silent in his chains. He made no speech, and stared at the rising flames with dry eyes. Lerna allowed him to remain until the fire burned down to embers, then ordered him returned to the dungeons, now crowded with other traitors awaiting the Queen's justice. Justice. She had watched the smoke blossom on the pyre, concealing Alucius's face, and sparing her the sight of the flames consuming his flesh. "What justice would I have shown you, old friend? Spy, traitor to the realm, and now hero of Varenshold's liberation. My father would have made show of forgiveness, lauded you with titles and gold, then, after a decent interval, had one of his hidden talents ensure a suitably accidental end. I would have been far crueler, Alucius. I would have made you follow me, stand witness as I administered full justice to our enemies, and for that, I know you would have hated me." The clouds above must have parted, for she felt a blush of warmth on her head, her new-grown hair no doubt making a fine sight as it shimmered, the sensation pleasant and free of the tear-inducing agony she recalled from her days on the Sea Sabre. "Healed?" she wondered again. "You can remake a mask, but the face beneath still lingers." She opened her eyes, and her gaze lit on something, a small yellow flower emerging from between two shattered flagstones. Lerna crouched, reaching out to touch a finger to the petals. "Winter bloom," she said. "Always the clearest signal of changing seasons. Ice and snow come, sister, bringing hardship but also respite. For no fleet will sail the ocean whilst winter storms rage." "You think they will come again?" Devoka asked. "When the ocean calms?" "I'm certain of it. This war is far from over." "Then you will need every sword, every ally." Lerna looked at the winter bloom again, resisting the urge to pluck it and resolving to plant a new garden here in time, one without walls. She rose, meeting Devoka's gaze and speaking in formal Lonak. "Servant of the mountain, I have need of your spear. Will you wield it in service to my purpose? Think well before you answer, for our road is long and I offer no promise of a return to the mountain." Devoka's reply betrayed no hint of hesitation. "My spear is yours, sister, for now and always." Lerna nodded her thanks, beckoning to Iltis and Benton. "Then you had best meet your brothers. Try not to kill Lord Iltis, his manner can be somewhat provoking." Carlin Algervan stood as straight as his somewhat bent back would allow. Lerna remembered him as a cheerful, pot-bellied fellow with a shiny bald head, less inclined to obsequiousness than many of his fellow nobles, and not one to linger at court longer than his business required. Slavery and hard labour, however, seemed to have robbed him of humour and belly alike. His cheeks were hollowed and his eyes sunken, though he met Lerna's gaze with admirable composure. His daughter, however, was less well attuned to royalty, and fidgeted as she stood before the throne, an appreciable gap between her and her father. Lady Ilion wore a hunter's garb, buckskin trews, and a light cotton blouse, stained brown and green to hide her in the forest, her hair cropped so it wouldn't encumber her eyes. A dagger sat in a sheath strapped to her ankle, with another at her wrist. Despite her martial accoutrements, she still seemed very young as she squirmed under the scrutiny of those present and avoided her father's glares. Behind her stood Brother Commander Solis and Devoca, whilst Lord Aljervin stood alone. Lerna had been quick to discard the garish monstrosity Darnell called a throne, in favour of a comfortable straight-backed chair retrieved from one of the abandoned merchants' houses, and found herself grateful for the depth of the cushion beneath the royal posterior. She had been hearing petitions for some 4 hours now, and could only marvel at the lingering pettiness of people fortunate enough to survive such a savage occupation. They came with complaints of theft against vanished neighbours, claims of inheritance for property now naught but ash, appeals for restitution of lordly status, and a plethora of other trivia that shortened her patience by the hour. However, not all claims were petty or easily resolved. "Brother Solis," Lerna said, "you must admit, Lord Aljervin makes several valid points. This is all very unusual."
"Forgive me, Highness," the Brother Commander replied in his customary rasp, "but I doubt anything in this realm could now be termed as usual.
My knowledge of your order's history is hardly copious, but I believe there has never been a sister of the Sixth Order. And are not recruits normally inducted at a much younger age? Circumstance may have forced us to forget some custom in the face of necessity, but this is a radical step indeed."
"There is provision in the Order's tenets to allow for older recruits, Highness. Master Renciel, for example, came to us as a former captain in the Realm Guard Cavalry. As for Lady Ilion's gender, war has provided ample evidence that our custom in this regard may require modification."
"Are our laws to be cast aside now, Highness?" Aljervin spoke up, once again glaring at Ilion. "The Sixth Order cannot just take a man's daughter."
"They aren't taking me," Ilion responded hotly, then flushed and lowered her gaze as Lerna turned to her.
"Your pardon, Highness."
"Lady Ilion," Lerna said, "is it truly your wish to join the Sixth Order?"
The girl drew breath and raised her head, speaking in a clear and certain tone.
"It is, Highness." "Despite your father's objections? His well-founded fears for your safety?"
Ilion glanced at Aljervin, her expression sorrowful and her voice low.
"I love my father, Highness. I thought him dead for so long. Finding him alive when the city fell was wondrous. But I am not the daughter he lost, nor can I be. I am fashioned by war into something else, a role, I believe, ordained for me by the departed."
"She is a child," Aljervin stated, his face reddening. "By the laws of this realm, her status and condition are mine to decide until her majority."
He quailed a little as Lerna met his gaze, refusing to look away, but adding, "Highness," in a strained whisper.
"Lady Devoca has told me much of your daughter, my lord," Lerna said. "By all accounts, she has served with great distinction in the struggle to free this realm.
She stands before me now, the author of many well-deserved ends suffered by our enemies. According to the Sixth Order's tenets, she is vouched for by a subject of good character, and Brother Solis is willing to accept her. Setting aside ancient custom and the usual test in recognition of her evident skill and courage, as a sister, she will no doubt provide even greater service to the realm and the faith. Whilst you, my lord, apparently spent the entire war carving fatuous art for the traitor Darnell."
Aljervin flinched, but managed to control his tone as he responded, "I hear rumour your Highness was also made a slave by our enemies. If so, I am sure you know well the shame of performing a hated act in pursuit of survival."
Iltis bridled, stepping forward and speaking in ominous tones.
"Caution your tongue, my lord."
Aljervin gritted his teeth, pausing before speaking on, his voice coarse and fighting a choke.
"Highness, I have no house, no wealth, no pride left. My daughter is all that remains to me. I ask you to cleave to our laws and prevent her taking this mad course."
"This is not injured pride," Lerna decided. "He simply wants to keep her alive. A good man and a builder with skills much needed when peace comes."
She looked again at Ilion, watching her reveal a set of perfect white teeth as she smiled at an encouraging nod from Devoka. Beautiful, but so is a hawk, and for now I have more need of hawks than builders. Lady Ilion, she said, gesturing for one of the three scribes present to formally record a royal pronouncement. Under the Queen's word, I hereby strip you of all rank and set aside your father's authority. As a free subject of this realm, you may choose any path open to you by law. She had been surprised to find the council chamber mostly intact, though there was a sizable gap in the west-facing wall, the tapestry that covered it flapping in the breeze. In a break with custom, Lerna had requested the two surviving aspects attend the council, formally appointing Aspect Alera as Minister of Royal Works and Dendrish as Minister of Justice. Neither her father nor her brother had ever appointed an aspect to an official position, and there had been some notable apprehension among the other council members. "Never give them an inch more than you have to," her father had once said of the faith. "I tied the crown to them to win the realm, but if I could, I'd sever them from me like a diseased limb." Lerna, however, felt time had taught a different lesson. Aspect Tendris's diatribes against her brother's toleration of Denaya beliefs had done much to weaken the realm, but his power had been limited by the closeness of the other orders to the crown. "Your mistake wasn't in binding to them, father. It was in not binding them tight enough." "As in Warnsclave, more people arrive by the day," Brother Holland reported, seated on Lerna's left. "The civil population of Varensold now stands at over 50,000. We can expect the figure to double within the month."
"Can we feed so many?" Velen asked him.
"With careful rationing," Brother Holland said, "and continued supply from our Alpiran friends, and Fieflord Darvis's provision of Nilsalian produce. The winter months will be hard, but none should starve." "How stands the army, my lord?" Lerna asked Velen.
"With our new recruits, Baron Banda's knights and common folk, we will have 80,000 men and women under arms before the year's end."
"We need more." Lerna turned to Lord Marshal Travic. "Tomorrow I will draft an edict of conscription. All realm subjects of fighting age will be inducted into the realm guard. Train them hard, my lord." She switched her gaze to Lady Reaver. "The edict will extend to all fiefs, my lady. I trust you have no objection." The lady governess maintained a neutral expression, but Lerna saw she was carefully phrasing her response. "For myself, Highness, no," she replied after a moment. "And for many of my people who suffered at Valerian hands. However, there are some corners of Cumbrail untouched by war, where old resentments will linger."
"To be dispelled by the Blessed Lady's words, I should hope," Lerna told her.
"Perhaps you should return home for a time, Lady Reaver. Let your people see you, hear the tale of your deeds, for they are so inspiring." Reaver's nod of assent was immediate, and her tone free of any rancor. "As your Highness commands." "Never the slightest glimmer of disloyalty from this one," Lerna mused. "So why does she cause me such unease?" She set the question aside for further consideration, and turned to the shield. "Fleet Lord El Nestra, please advise on the strength of your command." As was his wont these days, the shield's perpetual half-grin disappeared as he addressed her, his eyes only briefly meeting hers. "Just over 800 ships of varying drafts, Highness. We've captured quite a few Valerian traders, but the seas grow ever more empty as the winter storms descend." "A decent-sized force to repel any invasion," Count Marvin commented. "Crewed by the best sailors in the world. Plus, this time we are forewarned." "How many soldiers could your 800 ships carry?" Lerna asked El Nestra. The shield frowned in puzzlement, his tone cautious as he responded. "If we make full use of the Valerian vessels, perhaps 40,000, Highness? And certainly not in any comfort." "Comfort is a long-forgotten luxury, my lord." She calculated for a moment, feeling the silence thicken. "They know what you're about, and they fear it." "Your man is here?" she asked Velen, who nodded and ordered the realm guard on the door to bring in the shipwright. Sergeant Davin marched to the center of the chamber, giving a smart salute and a formal bow, seemingly completely untroubled by his august audience.
"My battle lord tells me you build ships, Sergeant," Lerna said.
"Indeed, Highness." He favoured her with a smile that would have shamed the shield for its innate confidence. "I was inducted into the Shipwrights Guild at 16, the youngest ever, so I'm told."
"Very impressive. I require a ship capable of carrying 500 soldiers across the ocean to Valeria. You will design and build it in such a manner so as to be easily duplicated and constructed by unskilled hands." Davin blanched as the other captains at the table stirred in discomfort. Apart, she noted, from Valin, who betrayed no surprise at all.
"Such a task is a mighty one, Highness," the sergeant began, "requiring much labour, not to say timber. Brother Holland has compiled the list of surviving subjects with suitable skills and experience," she told him. "They will be placed at your disposal. As for timber, rest assured it will be provided. I name you..." She pondered for a moment. "Davin Al-Jural, Master of the Queen's Yard. Congratulations, my lord. I shall expect your designs on the morrow."
Davin stood in dumb silence for a moment longer, then gave a hesitant bow and walked from the chamber.
"I believe that concludes today's business," Lerna said, rising. As expected, it was Count Marvin who spoke. The Nilsalian commander was brave by all accounts, but also unabashed in counselling caution.
"Highness, if I may..."
She paused, raising an eyebrow as he faltered, then forced himself to continue.
"So there is no misunderstanding. It is your Highness's intention to invade the Valerian Empire?"
"It is my intention to win this war, my lord, by the most expeditious means."
"To sail across the ocean with so many, I must voice my doubts as to the practicality of such a thing."
"Why? The Valerians managed it."
"With years of preparation," the shield pointed out, "and not born from a realm so damaged as this one."
"A realm that has already performed wonders." She scanned their faces, finding doubt on most, though once again Valin alone gave no sign of unease.
"My lords, this council is not a debating chamber. I ask for counsel as I see fit, and issue commands accordingly. And I command a fleet be built to carry our justice to the Valerian Empire, for when our business there is complete, they will never again dream of returning to this land save in their nightmares."
She paused, awaiting further dissent, but finding only wary acceptance.
"I thank you for your counsel, and set you to your duties."
Lakril Alhestian failed to rise when she entered his cell, merely glancing up at her with dull eyes, slumped in a corner on bare stone, shackles on his wrists and ankles. Iltis gave an angry grunt at the discourtesy, but Lerna restrained him with a wave.
"Guard the door, my lord, if you would."
Iltis bared his teeth at Alhestian in a disgusted snarl before exiting the cell, leaving the heavy door ajar and standing with his back turned.
"They call this the traitor's nook," Lerna told Alhestian, moving to the only window, a narrow gap in the thick stone wall through which a patch of sky could be glimpsed. There were faint marks on the stone, some ancient inscription scratched by desperate hands long ago.
"Last occupied by artist Alcendal on the eve of his execution," she went on, turning back to Alhestian.
"It speaks much for our enemies that, for all the destruction wrought on this city, they left our dungeons intact."
Alhestian gave the faintest of shrugs, his shackles sounding a dull clink.
"Artis Alcendal was given no trial," she continued. "Simply waking one morning to find a brace of guards at his door, holding a king's warrant. A week later, he was dead."
"Whilst I am afforded only 2 days," Alhestian said, his voice a toneless croak, "and also no trial."
"Then let this be your trial, my lord."
She raised her hands, gesturing at the surrounding walls. "And I witness and judge both, eager for your testimony."
"My testimony is redundant. My reason's plain."
He turned his gaze from her, resting his head against the wall.
"I make no defence or appeal for clemency, save that the matter be settled with all dispatch."
She had known this man since childhood, and never with any fondness, finding perhaps too clear a reflection in his naked ambition. But the sons with whom she had played as a child had never faltered in loving him, for all his flaws. "A Lucius will be honoured for all time in this realm," she said.
Your house is partially cleansed of dishonor by his sacrifice. A dead son has no need of honor, and I have two to face in the beyond, if you would do me the favor of sending me there." Her gaze went back to the scratches on the wall, finding two words legible in the scrawl sufficient to divine the meaning of the rest. "Death is but a gateway to the beyond." The catechism of faith, upon which so much had been built and also destroyed. To her it had always been empty words, devoid of interest when there was so much genuine wisdom to be read. "I have no mercy for you, my lord," she told him. "Only more punishment. Lord Iltis." The Lord Protector returned, standing at stiff readiness as she pointed to the shackles on Alhestian's ankles. "Remove those and bring him." Darnell's former knights and huntsmen stood blinking in the courtyard outside the cavernous vaults that served as the city's dungeons. They numbered perhaps 36 men, stripped of all armor and possessions, save for threadbare clothing, surrounded on all sides by Lord Adal's North Guard, chosen for the strength of their discipline. The Realm Guard were likely to commit massacre when faced with those who had betrayed them at the first fateful clash with the Valerians. Lerna led Alhestian to a walkway, looking down on the assembled prisoners, finding most too cowed to meet her gaze, though some stared up in silent entreaty. "You know these men, I believe?" Lerna asked him. Alhestian looked down at the captives, his impassive mask unchanged. "Not well enough to grieve their passing, if it is your Highness's intention to have me witness their murder." She moved away from him, and stepped closer to the edge of the walkway, raising her voice. "You all stand guilty of treason, and worthy of immediate execution. Many of you will no doubt make a defense of loyalty, service to an oath binding for life. I tell you now, this is no defense. An oath sworn to a traitorous madman is worthless, to be set aside by men of reason or true knightly honor. You have shown yourselves possessed of neither." She paused to glance at Alhestian, finding him meeting her gaze with grim understanding. "However," she spoke on, "the faith teaches us the value of forgiveness for acts truly regretted, and this realm stands in need of all hands fit to hold a sword. For these reasons alone, I offer you the chance to swear another oath, an oath to your queen. Swear your service to me, and I will spare your lives. But know that your sentence is not commuted. Condemned you stand, and condemned you remain, until the day battle claims you. You will be the dead company. Any who do not wish to swear this oath, speak now." She waited, watching them tremble and sag in relief. One man, a great, broad-chested fellow of knightly bearing, wept openly, whilst beside him a scrawny man, probably a hunter, stood shuddering, with urine flowing down both legs. She waited for a full minute, but no voices were raised. "My lord," she turned to Alhestian, gesturing at the men below, "your new commander waits, if you'll accept it." Lacryl Alhestian stood expressionless for some time, before replying with the smallest of bows. "Very well," she said. "In addition to these wretches, our patrols find the country to be depressingly rich in outlaws, scum preying on those fleeing the Valerians. Rapists and murderers will be executed, of course, but the remainder I'll send to you." She moved to his side, speaking softly. "You have your sons to thank for your life. And know well, I will not prove as kind as my father should you betray this realm once more." She returned to the palace in the evening, having spent the day amongst the newly arrived refugees, finding the usual mix of beggared nobles and dispossessed commoners, each with their own epic of woe and survival. As in Warnsclave, however, there were precious few children, and those mostly orphans. She had them gathered and conveyed to the palace rooms, set aside for Brother Innes's charges, where she spent the rest of the evening. It was amazing to see how quickly the children's spirits returned as they raced around her, loud with laughter and play, though there were a few who sat apart from the others, eyes haunted by lingering horrors. She spent most time with the silent ones, speaking in soft tones and trying to draw them out, usually with only marginal success,
though one little boy climbed into her lap and fell into an immediate sleep the moment she opened her arms to him.